Okay, everybody, welcome back to the Doomer Optimism podcast. Jason and I hosting again. We have here today Adam. Empty America is his Twitter handle. Adam, I will let you start by just like introducing yourself to the facts that you want people to know about yourself, obviously. So people more or less anonymity on Twitter. So whatever think you think would be good to start to frame the conversation so people can get to know who you are.
Oh, well, yeah, I'm not highly anonymous, but I guess just so people have some idea of, you know, who I am and what I do. I basically live in a relatively remote rural area of New Mexico. You know, I do a lot of different things. Like I put on my Twitter account. I mean, I currently, you know, I drive a school bus, and I've recently been getting into doing a little more writing, including, you know, a little more formal writing, a little more long form writing. I've had the time to do that, so they've gotten some interest in that. And I do a lot of gardening type experiments because I'm here and I have, you know, 16 inches of precipitation. It's a cold, a surprisingly cool, you know, semi-arid climate. So I do quite a bit of experiments with fruit trees, different vegetables that can be grown. And I share that on my Twitter account. I also have a little business where I sell knives that I've designed, a little different than your normal commercial stuff. It's kind of a small production knife business, and I go with, you know, the carbon steel, the hardwood, the leather sheath. So I have a little bit of a manufacturing thing going. And as I said, I also, just for entertainment, I've been kind of reading and writing a good deal about sort of world political issues, sort of bigger issues. And I think that's probably why I was invited onto the podcast, was that I wrote a article recently for Palladium magazine that got some attention. And it was a little bit of a historical dive into what actually happens in the case of major seemingly end of the world type disasters like the Black Plague, you know, the destruction of Berlin in World War II. So that's, I don't know which way we're going to go. We can talk gardening, we can talk history, we can talk, you know, attempts at predicting the future, really whatever you guys want.
I have one quick question before we get into the content, the substance, but are you just an autodidact? Like,
I wouldn't want to say that. I mean, I have a college degree in history, but I did learn Latin in college, and, you know, so I went to the University of Arizona, and I studied, you know, history and so forth, but I don't have a lot of, most of what I know has really nothing to do with that. You know, that I'm, you know, 20 years ago I was in college, and, you know, most of what I know, I just learn on my own. I don't really want to, it was just the college was just something to get a person started. You know, you have access to a good library. You know, you have some introduction, but I don't have any professional qualifications really in anything I talk about, especially other than, as I said, just a BA in history, and I have some, used to have some knowledge of the classics, but, you know, nothing too recent or relevant.
Well, that's so cool, because look, I've got my PhD, and the PhD process in general is like an exercise in getting like extremely specific in some topic. It doesn't make you like an expert it makes you an expert on that topic, but doesn't necessarily mean you can talk on a wide range of issues. And I swear every time I read one of your tweets, it's like surprising or a different way of thinking. And there's almost, there might also, this is like, sorry, I'm getting into a meta comment already, but there's also potentially something, whereas if you get the higher education, it forces you to think a certain way. And all of your tweets are always like upending how people normally think about things. So I'm excited for this conversation anyways.
Yeah,
Jesse,
so yeah, the stuff that I think about the most, I'm specifically uneducated in. So we'll put it that
yeah,
way.
and that's probably why it's so interesting, because nobody, like anyone who studies it formally, has to think about it in a certain way. So I'm always like, oh my God, I never would have thought of putting it that way. So where do you want to get started, Jason?
Well, yeah, I just wanted to add to that. I don't always agree with you, but I always find your posts counterintuitive and interesting. When I don't agree with it, I don't agree with it in an interesting way, or if I think it's wrong, I think it's wrong in an interesting way. Well, I just want to get a little bit more into your background. Like, so what drives you? So I lived in New Mexico for a long time growing up, from Taos and Albuquerque. I'm a bit familiar with that region, but what drives you to kind of live, extremely remotely and kind of bootstrap a livelihood from these different sources, and to be thinking about kind of deep, kind of historical structural issues? What drives that? In particular, and just to throw kind of, one of the things you've talked about, or bring it up, you've talked about how, a lot of doomer optimists are like, we need to kind of redistribute population, or that's going to happen naturally, not like forced. And rural areas need to kind of be revived. And I think you've kind of said that, well, actually, without fossil fuels, rural areas are just gonna it's gonna get much, much worse, because they're so much more dependent. And yet you're a very extremely rural person. And so do you see yourself as kind of an exception, kind of a lone, wanderer, or how do you frame all of that?
Well, it's an interesting question. The question of why I came out here has a lot of answers. I don't know. I had before, obviously. I had a, let me put it this way, a stressful career that's not particularly interesting, and I kind of deliberately just haven't gone into it. You know what I mean? So, I basically semi-retired at, we'll say, the age of 38 years old. Okay, I'm 41 or so now. So I made a drastic change in my life. Basically just 04, I'd say, man, I might have been younger than 38, but anyway, I was, 37 or 38, about, 4 to 5 years ago. I think 4 years ago I came out to New Mexico. I grew up in upstate New York. The reason why I came out is kind of obscure to me in retrospect. I definitely wanted to make a big, change of life and drastically downshift from a very stressful, long hours type of existence to an existence where I had the time finally to, maybe write a little, go into more of the things that I was interested in. So I like the why I went as remote as I did is kind of an obscure question. I mean, I guess I just wanted the experience. It's certainly a very low cost of living. It's sunny, but from when even from when I was a young kid, I always had that fascination, with the pioneers and, the most remote areas. And I just had that desire to experience that. And, I've got a family. I've got 4 kids. I had a little, a lot of other responsibilities. So, there was no way that I was gonna, enact my real childhood fantasy of, I don't know, going to, Paraguay or Uzbekistan, or what I used to dream of as a boy, reading all the travel books and everything. But basically, my kids were young enough that at that time the move wasn't a big deal for them. So we kind of came out here to the, I would not ever say the frontier, because the life is pretty usual here. It's a lot more normal than you'd think, but it's interesting at the same time. And I don't know if you want, Ashley, do you want me to kind of go into that, because that's a topic I've never really gotten into.
Yeah, that would be,
the,
I mean,
the,
it would
the
be,
day-to-day. Okay,
yeah,
I will go
yeah,
into
you,
this.
You talked about it, I've heard you say comment something along the lines of, like, on your school bus route, how far you're going.
Okay.
And that kind of thing. Yeah. And so just like, when you talk about where you live, I can't picture what's going on. Like, I don't
okay.
understand the landscape. So tell me what's going on.
All right.
There.
I'm going to try to explain it. And it's unusual. All right. So basically without, you know, I mean, telling people exactly where my house is, I live in, you know, northeastern New Mexico. I think you could honestly say, certainly you could never claim that it was the most remote area of the country. There are areas in eastern Montana or northern Nevada, certainly, that are more remote. But it was, we'd say, in the top, you know, top 10 most remote areas, just to give sort of the distances to things. If you want to, here's a good one. If you want to, and I'm just ballparking here, so if you want to buy groceries, there's like a really, you know, small grocery store that is, it's 70 miles one way. So it'd be a 140-mile round trip out to a grocery store. Walmart, once again, is pretty similar. It's an hour and a half or an hour and 45 minutes, you know, each way to the nearest Walmart. So it's essentially, it comes out to be, you know, over a 3-hour round trip. And that goes for everything. But people live out here. I mean, we've got a school, we've got a public school, and I drive the school bus for that and really enjoy it. The school is in a little village, okay? There's a defined village of, and it used to have about, you know, 300 people in it, okay? Now it has about 80 people in it. And the school is in the village, but the kids live out on the surrounding ranches. So if you want a picture, because what you can actually picture is like a little village, just like you'd expect, okay? Like the little old stone buildings or adobe buildings. And, you know, some of them are trailers too, or you know, whatever they may be. But a little New Mexico looking village, right? And in the village, you know, it used to be a lot bigger, but it's lost probably a quarter of its population. So you've got the school in the village. I actually live in another ghost town that's even more ghost town, about 10 miles outside of the village. But that's fairly convenient. And then 10 miles past me in the other direction is actually another village of maybe, 200 people that used to have probably 500 people. And there's another school there. So the way to describe it is it's an area of, essentially, it looks like the Great Plains. It was settled it's incredibly interesting because the area was, it was settled by the Spanish long ago. We don't even know how long ago it was. There's, you know, old ruins and stuff, but the modern framework of what we have here, what happened was that the railroad came out, okay? And this was in the early 20th century. So the railroad came out. And what happened was the Homestead Act went into effect. So the government was giving out 160 and 320 acre parcels, you know, for free for anyone that could prove them up. And as part of this homestead development, you had villages basically developed from scratch. Now, in some cases, there were some older Spanish structures around, but for the most part, the villages would be developed mostly from scratch along the railroad tracks where there would be a railroad stop. So that's why the villages are spaced exactly 10 miles apart along the run of the railroad track. So it'd be 10 miles a village, 10 miles a village, 10 miles a village. And also you had to have a village on a 10-mile basis because when this land was settled by the homesteaders, they predominantly did not have the automobile. So they were coming in on horses, wagons. So you had to have a center where they could come in to get services so that it would be no more than a, you know, about a 10-mile run in with a horse and wagon for the settlers. So what happened is it was 16 inches of rainfall on average. So on a really good year, you can get, or a good sequence of years, you can get dry land wheat crops. So of course, what happened was the settlers flooded in for that free land, and the population of the county peaked at, I think, 5,000 or 6,000. And they broke the prairie up. You can still see the old machinery abandoned all over the place. So they broke the prairie up, planted it in winter wheat. And surprisingly enough, it worked at first. I guess they came out here during a really wet phase. So this was in the early 20th century, like the 20s, the 30s. I mean, they were straight up large scale wheat farming, and you had three towns in the county, all of which had grocery stores. They had, you know, farriers for horseshoeing. They had farm equipment dealers. They had, you know, blacksmiths. And you could get anything you wanted because the train ran. You know, people, consumer goods came in on the train, and it was booming. And then, of course, we had the Dust Bowl. And that, everybody knows about the Dust Bowl. So the long story short is, after the Dust Bowl, a lot of people left during the Dust Bowl because what they were doing was completely unsustainable because the wind blew the soil away once the prairie grass was broken. So then you had a wave of consolidations. Okay, so you had the people that remained after the Dust Bowl bought the properties of their neighbors who left. So you started going from like 160 and 300 acre units, and you started going into 1,500, 2,000, 4,000 acre units, and they would put a lot of the ground, you know, back to grazing, but they did keep doing wheat. And I understand, because then the rain came back and they started growing wheat again. And my understanding is there was another big drought that slammed them in the 50s, and that drove another excess of population and another cycle of consolidation. And so what ended up was that the county population fell from between 5,000 to 6,000 in the early 20th century to about 600 now.
Wow. And what, and so people are mostly into ranching?
Yeah, I'm sorry to be so long-winded, but it's a long story. Okay, so yeah, so we went from 5,000 dryland crop farmers to now we're down to, I think, about 600. And there's basically 0 acres of crop left in the county, and almost all the land has been turned back over to cattle grazing, typically in, you know, large ranches of you know, up to 10,000 acres or more. You know, in the county produces, I don't know, 20 or 30,000 head of beef cattle a year. And all it takes to do that is a workforce of, you know, an active ranch workforce of maybe, I mean, including kids and spouses, the ranch population is probably, of the 600, the ranch population is probably, you know, 300. And then you have, you know, other people that work at the school. You have older people in the villages. But basically what happened was a change in the means of agricultural production just forced an extremely small and extremely dispersed population. So what I'm doing, I mean, I'm driving a school bus, 150, each run in morning and night, each one is 70 miles. So I'm running a total of 140 miles a day, a large part of which is dirt and rough gravel roads, because I'm just going out to these ranches, because I'm really quite central compared to these people. I'm going out to these ranches. I'm just picking a kid up here, picking a kid up there. And we have quite a more kids than you'd think around here. And I pick the kids up and bring them into the centrally located school. So that's basically my lifestyle, and I just have my own really small place. I just own like an acre and a half where I bought kind of a water right here, sort of, and I do my gardens here, and then I have a couple other lots where I'm able to graze my sheep, and that's pretty much how we do it.
Jason, where do you want to go from here? I have an idea, unless you have one.
I'm kind of interested to dig into your kind of gardening and sheep operation. I found some of the pictures you posted online, pretty fascinating. A lot of people think about gardening, they think about raised beds, and you're like, well, yeah, that's great if you have a high precipitation environment, but if you're in a 16 inch a year environment, you actually want to dig these beds into the ground.
You
want to talk about how you do that? I think that's pretty fascinating.
I that's a really good tip. I mean, it's just a hobby, I mean, I sell a little bit, but really it's not a big deal. It's just kind of a successful home garden that, like I said, it produces enough that I'm able to sell seed and it works. So basically, like I said, I do not try on the actual natural rainfall. With no irrigation, there's a very limited amount that you can do. I want to say probably my biggest interest that might be of great value to other people is that fruit trees are extremely drought hardy. And I never in my life would have known this until I got out here and I witnessed. I like to go around and sometimes photograph, the old failed homesteads. They're very picturesque. And 9 times out of 10, you roll up to a place that's been abandoned since, we'll say 1940, 1950. There's going to be a living apple tree, apricot tree, or pear tree still there at that residence. And a lot of times they actually fruit. And they do best, and everybody knew this, they learned, or if they didn't know it, they learned quick after they came. Everybody here knows to plant the fruit trees where the roof water drips down. So like the drip line of the roof, because most of the roofs don't have gutters, so the water comes straight down. So they grow best if there's, an old abandoned structure that's still, shedding water. But I've seen them to survive in the open without any type of, structure putting rainwater onto them. So, I mean, the first thing in these environments is that typically fruit is going to perform a lot better than you think. But the general method for fruit and vegetables that I use is the same, is that I always have to have like a contour of the soil. And it doesn't matter how you do it. It can be a sunken trench that you put your plants down into, or it can be, if you look online and Google waffle gardens, there's a Native American method where they make small, like 2 foot by 2 foot earth cells, or, since I have a hose and I can put a little more water than, the natives with their gourds did in the ancient days, I sometimes make like a 6 by 6 or an 8 by 8 square, like waffle looking cell. But like I said, the thing you can Google is waffle gardening. And what that lets you do, like when your typical person waters with a hose in their hand, they're just sort of sprinkling, and they see that the surface of the ground gets wet, and they think that they've watered the plants. But if you take your trowel and you dig a little bit when someone was watered in that way, you'll find that the soil 2 inches down is bone dry. Mm. And often all you've done is wet the surface, and then that water evaporates as soon as the sun comes out on it, and you've never watered the plant at all. So what I'm doing is the opposite of a raised bed. You've got some form of berm, no matter what it may be, around that plant. And you actually, in the kind of soils we have here, they're like windblown, like low soils, which is why the Dust Bowl happened. There's nothing wrong with the soils, but they're light. So there's no problem with drainage. So you actually want to put water on the plant until ideally that there's standing water a little bit, you know, in the earthwork, and let that run in. Because the thing to remember is they say that a vegetable garden, especially in, you know, 15% humidity and, you know, 12 out of 10 UV, needs 3 inches of water a week. So you would have to visualize that. So if you basically put on water 3 times during the week to where there's an inch of standing water on your vegetable, that's actually meeting its water needs.
Mm.
So it's a pretty simple trick. It's just got to get the water to the roots.
Mm. Did you have another question on that? Because I want to go to Scratchy's question while we're on Adam's production. Okay, so Scratchy asks, do you have any thoughts on the greenhouse you were considering or your hoop house thoughts?
My thought is I just haven't gotten the greenhouse done.
Okay.
the greenhouse I was talking about is, the design is real easy to find online, because I looked, and a lot of China, interestingly, like Western or Central China, has a climate very similar to the U.S. Great Plains. You know, China's eastern coast is climatically almost identical to the east coast of the United States, and the same goes as you move west. You know, China gets consistently more arid and more continental, just as we do. And they have a form of greenhouse there that I've only seen on the internet. But what it is you can Google, it's a Chinese solar greenhouse. And the basic theory is it's got a back wall of like massive brick or adobe masonry. So it basically, the greenhouse starts with a wall that's, you know, thick as you can make. It could be 3 feet thick, 8 feet high, and that's the back wall. And then obviously your south facing area has the you know, the plastic or the polycarbonate greenhouse material, so that the sun comes in and it heats that back wall, and it works as a thermal storage. And the Chinese actually at night, this is a lot of labor, but at night they actually have like a cover that they bring down over the glass part of the greenhouse to trap the solar radiation. So, and they use them in mass scale over there commercially. And it's basically a greenhouse design that accidentally they designed for us, a greenhouse for our exact climate out here, that to my knowledge, nobody's built on the plains. So,
okay.
You know, I just don't think anyone's done it yet. Hopefully I'll be the first, but I have too many projects at all times, you know?
It's perfect, because that's another thing you're known for, is the kind of brick and adobe masonry. So it's like...
Yeah, that's kind of a sidelight of mine. I got into masonry back in New York. I was actually kind of a family house back there is a stone house. So I gradually, a big stone house that, you know, always needs work, as you could imagine. So I gradually learned back there how to restore it, and, you know, about the different mortars and so forth. And so when I got out here, you know, I'd been to this area because, as I told you, I went to college in Tucson, Arizona. So I've lived in the South. This is my second go around in the Southwest, and a lot of my family is actually in Arizona. So, you know, I knew this area where I moved to before I moved to it, from just various trips and going through it and so forth. And one of the things I liked about out here was that there was a tremendous amount of, like I show on my Twitter, there's a tremendous amount of both stone and adobe buildings. So I've had some fun side jobs out here, you know, really going in and working on restorations of some of the old ones. And what's cool about it is that it lets you see exactly how they were made, because you're taking them apart and restoring them. And that's actually, this might interest the listeners, the tradition, the old Spanish method of making houses out here. And by old, I mean, I don't mean the vanished past. I would say from the last ones that were made in the truly traditional manner, they went up perhaps within living memory, you know, maybe the 40s. So we're not talking, you know, ancient history, but there's a collection of just unbelievably, I don't know what word I want to use, like medieval, if I could say that, unbelievably medieval vernacular Spanish style buildings here that I've been able to photograph and even physically work on some of them. And the method, the lack of purchased materials, I'm going to kind of go through it and maybe you can picture it. They had infinite labor, but almost no ability before the railroad came. Well, and even after it came, they didn't speak English, and many of them didn't have a lot of resources to be buying, you know, cash products. But they had a lot of labor. So what they would do is there's a red sand. This is typical. There was a red sandstone out here. So they would hand cut and shape the red sandstone into really usually fairly regular blocks. It varies. Some were, some weren't, but typically they'd cut it to some extent. And what they would then do is they would build the walls of the house out of these blocks of red sandstone, but the only mortar that would be used was dirt, was mud, adobe mortar, because you just mixed it from the soil on site. Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of a hybrid rock adobe wall. It's like an adobe wall using rocks instead of mud bricks for the structural elements. So they would build, you know, this wall up to about in whatever shape they wanted the house to be, into a square shape. And obviously you left openings for the windows and the doors. And then when the walls got up to heights, you'd take logs, you know, that would be cut here locally. Pine logs are called vigas in Spanish. Mm-hmm. So they would just lay the vigas across the top of this, you know, square 8-foot stone box, if you want to look at it that way. They'd lay the vigas, and then between, obviously, then you've got these big logs up there, and then between the vigas, they would split, you know, smaller junipers to make the latillas, and then they'd put them in like a herringbone fashion on top of the big beams to make like a solid deck. And so now this is kind of the crazy part. So once they've made a solid deck of wood, they'd build up the parapet wall around the outside, and the roof would actually be 10 inches to a foot of adobe mud put on top of the vigas, and it would be kind of tamped down and contoured so that it would drain out of specific canales, which are the drains that they would set in the building. So at the end of the day, and then you'd go into the interior, and they'd plaster the interior, the entire inside, with mud plaster, and then they do just the lightest, either like lime whitewash or maybe like the lightest layer of white lime over the whole interior. And so you'd end up with a finished, you know, you'd put a chimney and so forth, end up with a finished dwelling house that didn't contain number one, almost no nails contained, and the only purchased components would typically be the glass windows. So it's kind of astounding. I mean, if you wanted to build an exact replica right now, I mean, even with today's prices, I don't think if you did it exactly like they did, you wouldn't have $10,000 in a house, and probably a lot less. So it's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, and I think on that point, maybe it would be useful to talk a little bit about your article, because I'm thinking I think basically the thing that seems to me to go through the thread through your thinking is you're pretty clearly aware of the resource limitations determine what people do. You know, in the past you're talking about, you know, they had the railroad and then that impacted their like ability to do things in a certain way. What resources people have available. You just mentioned like infinite labor. Yeah, they have infinite labor, but not necessarily a lot of resources, or just access to a variety of resources. So that's why they did it this way. So maybe we could run through a little bit what your article was arguing and then maybe go into a little more like, I don't know, future prediction
part of
the conversation.
That's a great way to put it because I think you put it better than I would have, but that is kind of my common thread is that what I notice, and like you said, I'm kind of a, you know, self-taught or whatever, but what I notice is that the typical way of thinking of today is that people do not think in terms, they tend not to think in it. Everyone says people are materialistic today, right? They really aren't, though, in a realistic sense. That people very rarely think forward from material constraints. People today are so focused on their feelings and their, I don't know, their ideologies, that the sort of like the materialist reasoning is forgotten. Like the idea would be, well, the county here, well, why did the population leave? Oh, if we could have, you know, interested our young people in staying, it wouldn't have happened. But I mean, it happened because of switching from dry land wheat to cattle. And and a lot of things are like that.
Yep.
So, and I really have to give a ton of credit some of the people I've met out here, because I've talked to a lot of the older people out here, and I highly doubt they're listening to this podcast, but it really brought my thought forward more than anything possibly could have, because, you know, some of my friends here, they're in their 80s now. Okay. And, you know, they speak English as a second language. They grew up speaking only Spanish. And I mean, a good friend of mine who, you know, I do stuff with, like, we, you know, he's alive in, you know, 2022 and going strong. But I mean, his upbringing was that they were in, you know, a rock, like I was just describing, a rock house in, you know, a canyon with no road going to it that a car could go down. And they had no electricity. They had no running water. They had, you know, I would imagine, you know, virtually, you know, zero access to, you know, manufactured goods. I mean, his sister died of scarlet fever, you know, and they had no medical care. So it develops your perspective of reality that I stumbled into having, you know, this incredibly odd opportunity. I mean, it wouldn't be odd if you've been in the developing world, but within the United States, it was really incredibly interesting to me to really spend a lot of time with someone that could give firsthand description of, you know, not even a traditional lifestyle in the sense that people think of it now. I mean, people think traditional is like, I don't know, 1850, you know, in upstate New York with, you know what I mean, with a certain level of, you know, people riding the stagecoach to church and, you know, purchased clothes. And but these firsthand recollections from the 20th century are, you know, the true, you know, life of tradition, the true subsistence farming, you know, families of 8 to 10 children. You know, so I've actually gotten, you know, firsthand testimonies to that, and it really helped me to understand that when you don't just have things easily, everything that you do is directed towards survival, and that's how most of the world still lives right at this minute that we're talking. but just getting that through to people is incredibly difficult because it's an alien concept.
Yeah, and we were
that could happen.
In the U.S., where, like, so maybe it would be good to get into your article because, or you could briefly describe, like, what you're arguing in the Palladium magazine article because.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That one is, it's specifically based, your vision is specifically based on the current developed world. And so, and then we can maybe get into, do you think, I'd be curious to hear after, I just don't want to forget this question. Do you think that there is going to be a period where the developed world becomes like undeveloped, you know, where there's like formerly developed countries? I'm curious about that. So let's get into the argument from Palladium first and then like do some future prediction.
Okay, yeah. So Palladium. So basically what I did on that article, if you want to put it this way, is everybody talks about, you know, as we know, they talk about collapse, the concept, which I am skeptical on, that the developed world could receive a shock to the point of essentially, you know, halting the basic systems that we live under. So what I kind of decided to do in that article, and this really was an area where, you know, my having some training in history was beneficial to me, I decided to sort of test this theory. And in an interesting way is I went back through essentially history since the late medieval period, and I looked, which of course is in the West mostly, which is like the predecessor of our own system, right? You know, back to the, you know, Magna Carta or whatever, as they all say. So I went back and tried to find the most profound shock events that actually happened. And then I went and did some research as to, you know, how deep the shock was, and more to the point, how the system responded to the shock and how long it took for the system to essentially return to a form of equilibrium that conserved the basic functions of the prior state. And I started, the best one was the Black Death, okay, because we've had, you know, the pandemic, so that's an obvious one. And of course, the Black Death, when, you know, when they say the Black Death, they meant it. People argue about the death toll. I mean, some people say 20, some people say 50, but I mean, profound death toll. You know, we just lived through something, what do they say, 0.5% mortality. Which is not fun. I mean, if you know 200 people, you know people that died. But, you know, just to compare that with something that could have gone as high as 50% is almost unimaginable to us. But the crazy thing was, when I went back and looked, you just don't see the persistent collapse of anything. And the example that I used, just to bring it to the highest level of absurdity, was I focused on the court system, because nobody likes the courts, right? You imagine in all these zombie movies and stuff, there's nobody running around like serving you with an eviction notice. You know, it's just total absurdity to think that this paperwork in courts and bureaucracy, you know, people think that would just collapse, you know, in the face of a very slight challenge. So I went back. And it turned out that the courts in England were running. They ran right through the peak of the Black Death. There were a few, you know, temporary shutdowns, kind of similar to what we had in this country, of a matter of, I don't remember, 2 to 1 term, which would be like 2 to 3 months. But generally, the courts ran, the legal system functioned, and it's, the courts were actually, in some cases, busier. Because what was happening was people were dying of the Black Plague, and you were having inheritance disputes. So the heirs were in court trying to, you know, fight over these properties. And the other fascinating thing that happened was, you know, a lot of people in those days perceived this as the end of the world, as you might rationally do. You know, if say 30% of your community is, you know, falling dead and buildings are abandoned, so people that were still alive largely large numbers of them stopped working. They started wandering the roads, you know, doing penance. And actually, even at that early time in the 1300s, you know, the government of England had the capacity to pass what they called a Statute of Laborers, which was essentially a draft-like mechanism which compelled all able-bodied persons under the age of 30 to essentially report to productive work. And if you were, you know, seen to be what they use all these colorful expressions like vagabonds and sturdy beggars, you know, if you were seen to be someone that, you know, was physically fit and was out wandering the roads, they would arrest you and put you into a workplace. And they also imposed price controls. And, you know, and by all the historical evidence, you know, the peak of the Black Death was 1348. And by certainly at a minimum, by about 1352, essentially England was running again. And they had price controls and mandatory employment. And it just didn't, I mean, there's other than localized and short-term situations, you know, it didn't cause anarchy. You know, and then I kind of speed forward in time, and another good one was World War II. You know, there was a lot of in World War II, the point being the tremendous speed of the recovery. You know, we've all seen the destruction that occurred in Berlin. We've, you know, seen the pictures of the, you know, the Soviet flag being raised above the Reichstag and everything, and just the whole city, you know, just looks like absolute devastation. But I actually put a hyperlink in the article, and this is just the absolute killer, is that there's a video on YouTube of people waiting, and this is, I think it's 1946. It may either be late 1945 or early 1946. And keeping in mind, Berlin fell in April of 1945. So I think it was spring of 1946, and it may even have been earlier. There's workers sitting there along a streetcar line waiting for the streetcar, and the whole background is just like destroyed buildings. But the streetcar comes, and the workers pile on, and they go to work. And if you think about it logically, if you went to West Berlin in 1950, we all know that Berlin was there. I mean, it would have been, I wouldn't say absolutely normal. You would have seen the damage, but I mean, shops would have been running. Obviously, the streetcars would have been running for 5 years. People would be receiving their salaries, and the shock just didn't abolish sort of the basic. You still had to pay your rent, you know. I mean, Berlin, if you were living in Berlin, my other example, which people hate, is that, you know, if you were living in Berlin, just an ordinary worker, you know, and during all these events, you probably paid your rent every month until, you know, we'll say your last rent payment was March of 1945. You know, the city fell in April of 1945. You know, if you wanted to keep living in your flat, you were probably back to work getting paid and paying rent by Christmas. It just, you know, it's amazing.
Sorry to interrupt, but I
no,
honestly
go ahead.
Feel, Jason, maybe you have some thoughts on this, but this is so central. I think the practical realities that you just laid out are so central to the whole thing with doomer optimism. And I'm probably going to put it worse than Jason could, and maybe I'll just make Jason say after I do. But like, I think there is totally an ideology in straight doomerism that's like once the collapse comes, I'll be liberated. Like I'll be. It's almost like, you know, paradise on earth or something. Like once it comes, then I'll get into my regenerative village. That'll give me the excuse to be a blacksmith finally, or whatever it is, whatever fantasy people have. And I love this because people hate hate hearing it. Like, and increasingly, the more we go on, I already kind of knew this intuitively, but the more we go on having these conversations, the more I go on into my homestead project, I realize like no big social thing is really going to like make one big shift that changes all of the opportunities, agency, resources, and everything. It's really just like you have to make the world you want to live in and you have to do the work. Jason, did you have some thoughts on that?
Well, there's a couple, I guess there's a couple variables that I'm interested if you came across in your research. One is kind of, you know, the difference between the central core and the periphery, right? Mm. So it's one thing to be in Berlin, middle Berlin, it's another thing to be kind of on the outskirts. But then also, you know, what you're describing here are these kind of external shocks to the system. Whereas, you know, another set of shocks that are maybe more slow motion, but perhaps inexorable, might be something like net energy decline, or it might be, you know, topsoil loss or deforestation, or, you know, draining of the aquifer or depletion of the aquifer, right? Which is not an overnight thing, but, you know, if it's an, you know, if you're living an unsustainable lifestyle and you can't afford to maintain your current infrastructure, say if net energy declines, then something is going to shift. It's just not going to be, it's not going to be dramatic, but there will be kind of materially enforced kind of evolution of the system. I'm curious how both, you know, central core periphery and kind of resource constraints, changing resource constraints, fit into this kind of this theory or this kind of framing that you have.
Yeah, I mean it's really not really a theory so much as just an observation that may or may not hold true going forward. It's sort of the default, I guess we could say. So there's a couple things to that are really interesting, and I couldn't go into this nearly as far as I would have liked to in that article, but. Okay, so when I'm saying that all these like external physical shocks don't really change the system, that's true. But the funny part is we know systems have been, you know, radically changed during the 20th century. Absolutely. And I put in the article, you know, I said, okay, so I'm giving you the example of, you know, West Berlin. And I don't know if I put it in the article, but you know, the streetcars ran in Hiroshima 3 days or after the bombing and so forth. But I'm leaving something out, and you can kind of call me on this, is how about Cuba? Let's say you were, you know, a pre-revolutionary farm owner in Cuba. How about if you were, you know, a landlord in China, you know, in 1940? What if you were someone who lived in East Berlin? See, what's funny is all of those people's lives did change radically, but in some cases there was a level of resource shock to it. But the primary driver of these radical changes, you know, on the scale that people fantasize about, is actually purely political. Sometimes the political change, the radical political change, it sometimes rides on, you know, something like a famine or a drought, or, you know, the destruction of a war. But, you know, the destruction in itself seems to be neither, you know, necessary nor sufficient for these, you know, deep changes in life. And I mean, I am absolutely not a promoter of communism, but I'm just expressing that historically, the one thing that actually did cause, you know, the types of change that people fantasize about was generally forms of communism and Maoism. So that's kind of odd that, you know, that when the human mind changes deeply, that actually drives the heaviest changes in society. As far as the periphery, I mean, that's an incredibly interesting question, because and we really don't have to look to history, because, you know, we can look now at the least developed countries on Earth, and we can see essentially what they do, what they have, and what they, you know, can't generally support. So the interesting things that they do have is, and if you've done any business overseas, which I have, what you find is that the proliferation of, the cell phone, is tremendous. And even the smartphone, and even the apps have penetrated farther than people probably understand. I mean, you can transfer money right now readily from using certain apps with a smartphone to, some of the most exotic countries on earth, entirely legally, and it appears in the recipient's, bank account within, in some cases, one day, and you can actually track that yourself. But what's exotic is that in some of these cases, you're engaging in this futuristic activity, but if you were to go to the place in question, they often don't. And generally, I haven't traveled widely. Okay, so this is generally armchair speculation, but they're often not going to have the basic sort of like hard infrastructure of modernity. So this person that you're perhaps doing business with in a least developed country or a developing country, they've got a smartphone and they have some form of, in some cases, not necessarily do they have a bank account, but they're on an app where they can withdraw cash based on the app, but they would not necessarily have a personal automobile. There would not necessarily be, a paved road in their location. There generally wouldn't be, landline or fiber optic communication. The only internet service actually runs on the cell network. So, it's peculiar if you really sort of look down and study. Let's take the Central African Republic, okay? Generally said to be the least developed country on earth, okay? That's from the UN and so forth. And if you really look, nobody knows anything about this country, so I'll just say it's larger than Texas, it's larger than the Ukraine. Country located in essentially the exact sort of central North Africa, inland, heavily landlocked. And what's funny about it is they have a capital, okay? And you can see the capital on YouTube. You can, look at it on maps, and you can get on an airplane. I can get on an airplane. Okay, I can drive to Amarillo, Texas, theoretically, get on an airplane, and I can't even pronounce the name of the capital, but I can fly into the Central African Republic. I can get off the airplane. I can have service on a cellular phone, assuming I have the right chips. You can go to a hotel that has hot running water, has electricity, has anything that you would expect to have. But what's really strange about this is outside of that, in every country on earth, by the way, has this sort of, and I mean everyone, I don't, you may bust me on Bhutan, but every other one has got this core, this little kernel of essentially what I would call full modernity, meaning you've got your, hot running water, cold running water, paved roads, automobiles. But in the least developed countries, the kernel is incredibly small and tight, and there's almost no extension of infrastructure across the land. So in like the least developed countries, you'll have immediately adjacent to this, small kernel of what functions as full modernity with an airport with security and air traffic control and everything else, U.S., national European carriers land there. But outside of this, you'll have a shanty town. And it can be sometimes millions of people. Some of these least developed world urban conglomerations can be 15 to 20 million people. and it's essentially you'll have a vast, you know, shantytown area surrounding this node that's been placed there that interacts with the outside world. And in the extreme examples, you know, such as Central African Republic, if you look at a light pollution map, there's virtually no extension of even electricity outside of the capital. There's virtually no pavement, no electricity, you know, no services of any kind. There's almost no infrastructural expansion away from the core. And if you also look at these countries, and this is a little bit of a challenge to a lot of what, you know, people think perhaps in doom or optimism, you know, if you want some contrarianism, if you look at the statistics, what generally happens in countries with serious, you know, economic and resource challenges is if you look at their rate of urbanization, it's an extreme urbanization rate. The flow of the population actually is in towards these central cores where essentially, if you want to put it that way, the lights are on. And that's kind of interesting. And another core periphery thing I can bring out, which I think is a pretty good example, is the country of Argentina. And I think, Ashley, I'm kind of being a little risky here because I'm almost sure that you know a lot more about Argentina than I do. So
we'll
kind of check me out if I'm going off the reservation here. But my understanding is that I don't need to go through the whole history of Argentina, but we all know about the repetitive currency collapses that Argentina has had. I mean, we talk about like a collapse of the U.S. dollar, which, by the way, never actually seems to happen, and is one of the most overhyped things imaginable. But anyway, you know, people talk about the collapse of the U.S. dollar as something that would, you know, fundamentally, possibly even break up, or, you know, essentially they see that as the end of the world. You know, if the U.S. dollar was to fundamentally collapse or endure hyperinflation. But of course, as we know in Argentina, the Argentine peso has a long history, you know, of both deliberate devaluations and in, you know, collapses due to movements in the Forex market, including, you know, some which were apparently, you know, orchestrated by outside investors that were shorting the currency. So anyway, so the Argentine peso has essentially collapsed over and over again. I think it could be 3 to 4 like major collapses, unlike, you know, anything that's ever happened in America. But what has happened is, of course, the country of Argentina is still there. It's in no evident danger of dissolution. But my understanding of what has happened is that Argentina has become one of the most concentrated populations on Earth. And I'm not in front of a computer, but I think that if you Google it, the percentage of their total population that's come over the last, you know, 50 years or so and concentrated into the Buenos Aires metropolitan area is astonishing. I think, and I may be off the rails, I think it may be as high as 80% out of a country which is, of course, you know, vast. It's, I don't know what, 1,800 miles long, or, you know, it's on almost the scale of the U.S. I think 80% of their population is pulled in to this one metropolitan area. So in a sense, it's functioned, you know, I consider Argentina to be a developed country that has endured, you know, currency shocks and economic problems that has almost, and I don't want to offend any Argentines, but has almost pushed it towards almost falling out of the, you know, the developed country group. And I think that, you know, if you look at what actually happened, it seems to me, and it could be a coincidence, but it seems to me that you've got the same pattern, that you've got inward concentration of population as a result of, you know, the economic shocks. So that really kind of is different than we assume that economic shocks would, you know, result in a return to the countryside. But so that's kind of my contrarianism, is I haven't seen a lot of places that happened.
Okay, one thing, I just looked it up. It's 92% Argentina, 92% urban.
No way. Well, that would be the other cities too, but.
Right, not just Buenos Aires, but, and Uruguay, I just looked up, is 95% urban.
Okay, yeah.
So, and I don't know how they're doing those numbers, if ever, like, whatever town over X number of people is considered urban too, you know, that kind of thing. I'd have to look into it, but that's shocking to me. But okay. The long view that we always take, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, is that this increasing urbanization is a result of relatively cheap energy. So like, even if there is a crisis in Argentina on currency, still relative, it takes a ton of energy to bring resources into cities. So I'm wondering where you stand on that. You know, I just like, is it just a fantasy that we're going to repopulate the countryside? You know, I mean, cause I think I'm trying to think historically, like, was there ever a historical period where we had this amount of urbanization with that, this small amount of population rural? Like, can that be sustained for much longer?
Well, I don't know, because I mean, the way that it works currently is that essentially, I mean, obviously what it runs on, this is the other kind of funny thing that it's hard to get people to grasp, once again, on material reality, is that it all runs on gasoline.
Right.
So, I mean, to state the most, I mean, it's not even worth saying, but.
No, but I think,
mean,
it is
we,
worth
we,
saying.
We
I
kind
think
of
a lot
have
of
to say it, you know?
Yeah, they don't think about, they really just don't think about the extent. I think it's crazy how niche of a group of people understands liquid fuels versus other forms of energy, and how essential they are and how hard they are to transfer to other forms of energy.
Okay, so as far as the sustainability of it, my opinion is, and I think there's some truth to this, that if, and this is a big if, and it probably won't happen, okay, but just imagine, if fossil fuel, particularly liquid petroleum, were to be available, some of the questions of, you know, sustainability, to some extent, don't, you can defer the question of sustainability almost indefinitely, because let's say you give me, you know, a free amount of, you know, cheap diesel fuel. Okay, you can take sand. I've actually experimented a little with this, but anyway, you can take beach sand. You know, say you've absolutely, you know, destroyed the topsoil of an area beyond imagination, where there's no organic material, there's no nothing. The only thing that's left is like the coarse particles, like the subsoil beach sand type stuff. Okay, so if you've got the power to do so, you know, you can, you know, put in a borehole well. You can use, once again, everything's using diesel. Your boring rig runs on diesel. You're putting a diesel powered pump in that well down to the aquifer. Okay, as long as the aquifer lasts. And you're bringing up the water, and what you can then do is into that ear, and then you know the pivots, the big round irrigators, they make like the green circles we all see from the airplane.
Yes.
Okay, so you can run that water into a pivot, and I see, there's a lot of this kind of agriculture just east of me, so it's something I get to see in person, and some of it is in literal sand. So you can run a pivot off of the aquifer and into that irrigation water. You can actually meter in a full nutrient profile and now keep in mind, all these nutrients are created once again from fossil fuels. You know, they make fertilizer, you know, essentially by a process of cracking natural gas. So you can meter in the full, you know, nutrient profile that plant needs and, you know, fertigate it with the water, and you can produce, you know, a crop without any topsoil or, you know, any organic material. And as long as you've got the water to put on that crop, you know, or if you're somewhere that rains, like in the United States Corn Belt, you know, the further eastern Corn Belt, we can forget about the irrigation. You know, a lot of those places, the natural fertility of that soil is gone. I mean, they essentially treat the field each spring with essentially, you might as well be growing in like a neutral medium, you know, like hydroponics. They're essentially adding on an annual basis. You know, they're bringing that soil up to what the plants need to grow. And the corn will grow. I mean, if it's in a something to hold the roots, you know, it could be beach sand or, you know, it could be ground up beer bottles for that matter. If there's something to hold the roots and you're putting on the nutrient that it needs and it rains, I mean, the corn will grow. So really the question is, once again, it's just the fossil fuel, because every step of that requires the fossil fuel. It's not something that's going to fail just because it's not, you know, organic or, you know, desirable, which it may not be, you know,
right.
but the crop will keep coming up. And then, okay, so the crop comes up, and then obviously you've got to truck the crop. But that's kind of one of my other points. This is interesting. The transport of crops is not quite as inefficient as you'd think, because a semi truck, which will carry 44,000 pounds of cargo, when it's running under load, believe it or not, it gets 8 to 9 miles per gallon.
Hmm.
So, I mean, it's only burning twice the fuel of some family cars, and it could be pulling, you know, 44,000 pounds of corn, or, you know, 45,000 pounds of beef. So, you know, the in comparison to the calories that truck is moving, you're not really putting a ton of calorie back into the tank. So anyway, I'm sorry, I'm rambling. Let me get to the point. The point is that it's absolutely true that to produce the calories without a lot of labor, okay, you need the fossil fuels. And to move, that's probably even more important than moving the fuels. Yes, you need fossil fuels to move the calories, but to produce the calories without humans out on the ground working, everything that you're doing, it is requiring, you know, the fossil fuels. I think the problem or the trick, and I don't really know how this is gonna come out, was saying that, you know, the urbanization is allowed by cheap fossil fuel, is that it's very easy to burn more fuel in supplying a human who is living, you know, a typical American lifestyle outside of a city. In a certain sense, supplying that person can very easily burn more fuel than it would to bring food to that person by transport.
Right.
So here's my best thing.
It would have to be hand in hand. The ruralization would have to be hand in hand with self-production, like significant increases in self-production, which may or may not be possible in the American context rapidly, because I think we've seen a bunch of times online, like people just balking at the idea of like having a garden or keeping chickens. They're like, okay, Pol Pot, you know, telling me to grow food, how dare you, you're a dictator, kind of thing. So I'm for me, like the, so that when you were in your article, you were talking about the political messaging and the political project in combination with like resource changes over time is really the combination that makes the change.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously possible for human beings to support themselves on the land. I mean, I could never claim, you know, otherwise, but I guess the thing is that that my observation would suggest that, you know, when a country is really short of resources, it almost seems like to a certain extent, it's easier and cheaper to provide, if the demand is for a certain standard of life, okay, which is kind of inflexible to where you are, okay? Like you want, electricity from the wire, you know, you want a, you know, a flushing toilet, you want running water, you want, you know, heat with a thermostat, okay? So if we consider the lifestyle demand to be more or less a fixed thing, it's typically going to be easier, I think, and cheaper to provide that fixed level of lifestyle in a concentrated area. And of course the discussion becomes totally different if the population that wants to stay out on the land is not going for quite that standard of lifestyle. So just to go to that, like there are people, when we look at who is the closest to, this is kind of one of my other points I irritate people with, okay? If you look at the people that are closest, you know, to living a self-sufficient, truly self-sufficient lifestyle and a sustainable one, and, you know, we're, once again, it triggers some people, but we're, the closest people are probably, we would say, some of the Amish communities. Now, everyone's going to point out that, you know, they shop at Dollar General, okay? And I've lived near them, and they absolutely do. It's not as purist a thing as people think. Like, they go to the gas station, you know, they buy gas for the sawmills. But I think you've got to admit, you know, that even their biggest skeptic has to admit that they are, you know, closer than any other identifiable group of Americans to essentially living a lifestyle where you could say, yes, this person is out on the land and they're clearly making net production over what they consume. And also you would say that it's sustainable because, unlike some of these, you know, voluntary adult communities or communes, you know, you can look at them and you can say, okay, this is verifiable that it goes from one generation to the next. We know that this is something that, number one, rapidly increases the numbers, and number two, you know, we know that this appears to be have legs, you know, multi-generationally. So anyway, my point is, though, but when you look at what they really do, and I've known, you know, Amish and Mennonites, and I respect them, but when you look at what they actually do, it's very different socially than what modern people are really comfortable with. You know, everyone focuses on, you know, the fact that they don't have electricity, okay, but, or the buggies. But, you know, that's not really a big deal because they have workarounds. Most of them have, you know, certain propane appliances. You know, your average person could actually live, could learn probably without too much agony to live in that material way, but what people could not tolerate would be actually living in that social way. I mean, that is an extraordinarily conservative way of life. If you really think about it, the large families of 6, 7, and 8, which, you know, in observation seem to be critical to the way they actually farm. You know, kids are simply, you know, the kids do not go to school past eighth grade. You know, the girls are marrying typically in their late teens, and it's at least, you know, a semi-arranged marriage And frankly, you know, there's certainly, you know, absolutely no tolerance for, you know, any sort of, you know, alternative lifestyle. And in fact, if you were involved in that, you were what's called banished or shunned from the community. So I think that's the other challenge is, and if you look at traditional agrarian communities throughout the world and throughout history, you know, they usually have and have had, you know, social patterns that are extraordinarily offensive and unpalatable, you know, ironically to the exact same people in many cases who seem to be interested you know, in a return to the land. And once again, I can't prove that you couldn't successfully return to the land with like a totally, you know, radically, you know, left mindset. I can't prove that. Someone may go out and do it, you know, with like a commune and, you know, the children raised by the group and, you know, no marriages. And I mean, they may go do that. I can't say that someone can't do something, but it doesn't seem to be the pattern. And you wonder if all this stringency wasn't required, why does it seem to be the common pattern? So that's really, I think people could get used to the buggy, but I don't think they could get used to the rest of it. That's kind of my joke.
No, that's good. Jason, you had a question.
Yeah, well, I just have a kind of a constellation of thoughts that I'll try and string together into a comment and question. So it seems like part of, you know, what you're arguing is that, you know, if we were to, you know, if we're in kind of an era of slow motion collapse, you see it actually increasing the level of urbanization. You know, for example, like you mentioned in a post that, you know, in terms of using fossil fuels, industrial agriculture will be kind of like the last thing that's still using it because they need to deliver food to the cities. And so that, you know, people might not be driving their personal vehicles, but you're still going to have tractors, you're still going to have trucks moving these goods. And I want to contrast that with, you know, this other point that, you know, throughout most of human history, it has been mostly rural. And so we can ask, well, what's the difference with modernity? And I would say it's fossil fuels and also kind of technologies as well that were enabled by this. And the social norms of these rural areas, you know, throughout most of history were very conservative, not very palatable to, say, a modern back-to-lander sensibility. Well, maybe some, but certainly not all. And I'm just wondering, do you see, is that kind of how you see the future playing out in the next, say, 100 years, is that resources will become more constrained, will become more like the Central African Republic, with a lot of shanty towns around cities, and, you know, the people in rural areas kind of, you know, very sparse, a few kind of pioneers like yourself, just kind of like making it work, and then some very conservative communities. Is that kind of how you see the future developing?
Well, okay, that's a good point, because one of the things that I've thought through, and I've never really seen a great contradiction to this, is that one of my basic thought processes is that the electricity, the power of the lights, is going to stay on, okay? Because, I mean, I looked at, we generate a lot from natural gas right now, okay? So they say that there's, you know, something like, you know, 90 years worth of natural gas. There's something like, now I know there's issues with burning coal, but the truth is, you know, there's considerable amounts of coal there, and it, you know, we can't really speculate on nuclear. So I mean, I guess we have to assume, you know, that there's not a huge breakthrough. I mean, certainly there could be, but that kind of puts us into like a science fiction timeline that has, you know, nothing to do with, you know, scarcity. So anyway, you know, but there's certainly fission. So my thought process would be, once again, that, you know, the basically the lights essentially, so to speak, are going to stay on. And there's going to be electricity. I mean, and there's a lot that you can do with electricity. Okay, but electricity is kind of structurally.
Too, right?
Oh, what's that, Jason?
And cell phones too, as well, right?
Yeah, and electricity has a funny characteristic that's very different than liquid fuel. It's electricity is centralizing. It more or less, you know, it travels typically through wires, whereas liquid fuel kind of you can put it in a tank. And then you can just go. So liquid fuel, cheap liquid fuel, so cheap that we can burn it, frankly, foolishly, okay, is a very expansionary, you know, type of thing. It makes it very easy to have, like, you know, a good paved road, you know, in the middle of nowhere. Whereas electricity, it changes the incentives. It says, okay, well, if we need to get the corn from this rural area, yes, we can run an electric powered train and bring it, and there's no problem. But it doesn't sort of stimulate the tremendous sort of, I don't know if you want to say sprawl, but so I'm not really into a big collapse scenario. It's simply that, and it may never be recognized as a collapse. I mean, so people that are in a city, for instance, you know, in 20, 30, 40 years, they may see things going on, you know, around them that are an advancement, you know, of what we have now, and there's not going to be, like, you know, a headline, you know, that the United States collapses or anything of that nature. But I mean, I guess the way I would put it, let me go back to my own community that I've enjoyed so much here. Okay, this community did collapse. It happened, but I'm here. Like, it's fine. It literally, absolutely collapsed. I mean, it was a rural community, you know, a rural county, like I was telling you, with three pretty good sized villages. It had, there's an abandoned movie theater up the road. I mean, it was like a kind of, you know, a normal sized, you know, American small town community. And, you know, it more or less, you could say, I don't want to say collapse because I don't mean to malign it. I mean, we have everything we need, and the county is a heavy, you know, a heavy net producer of certain commodities. You know, it produces beef, it produces carbon dioxide, which is, you know, commercially exported into industry. It's just that the population is just, you know, infinitely lower. So it might be that so when we're talking about, you know, rural populations dropping, you know, down to people that are either commercial farmers or basically people that are wanting to live in a more rustic way, that may just happen very slowly, just like it did here, and it may not be tremendously remarked upon. Okay, so Jason, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because there was some beeping on the line.
Oh.
So let me say the one thing I want to say is, okay, the one part of the U.S. rural lifestyle that is the most unusual in the world and is logically, you know, the most, you know, likely to come under pressure is what I would call the, I don't know what the word I'm grasping for is, but most countries, if you really look at them, they do not have in the deeper countryside, and I don't just mean the Central African Republic, I mean Australia, Argentina, you know, even large parts of Europe, you know, if you look at like property listings in Europe, you're seeing like France or Spain, you know, and I've been to Spain and went into some of these areas. Like a lot of the properties, the homes are for sale, don't have public electricity. So the thing about the U.S. is that there's been, and I think you could verify this with numbers, this is just my gut feeling, just an unbelievably strong extension, okay, of every kind of infrastructure, you know, to every corner, you know, of this country, whether it's serving any real purpose or not. Okay, so like I was saying, I'm in, you know, this highly remote area, but I've kind of been trying to emphasize that it's normal in a weird way. Okay, I've got fiber optic internet. I have zero problem getting online and doing, you know, anything I need to do. Right now I'm talking on a landline phone. Okay, I mostly burn wood, but I have a propane tank outside my house, and you know, a truck, if I call, comes from, you know, I don't know, 100 miles away, and you know, and fills the propane tank. I mean, I live on a dirt road, but when I go up to the, I drive up to the paved road, I get onto, you know, a two-lane, you know, paved highway that's been, you know, extended, you know, out into the, you know, the midst of here. And that's kind of what got me thinking, is after I moved out here, I was like, can this really go on? I mean, forget about a collapse, because it wouldn't require a collapse. I mean, if the country just kind of says, listen, you know, we still have gas, but it's permanently going to cost, you know, the equivalent of $8 a gallon in our terms, what I see is a pullback of population towards the cities, just because it would become impossible to maintain the same standards. That's my argument, Jason. So.
Yeah. That, I mean, to me, the takeaway, now that we're talking long form, it's really becoming clear. It's much messier and more complicated than this linear or binary thing we're always trying to think of as like the before times and the after times, or like urban or rural, and then like urban somehow magically looks like, you know, 1850s carriages and big families, but they, like, we have none of the cultural infrastructure to get there. Maybe it doesn't, I mean, in some ways, some of the things you're talking about, what comes to mind is this like solar punk aesthetic, which I like hate because I love the carriages, but it's like this idea that we're just going to be repurposing a bunch of like plastic and electronics, and that'll be a mix. It'll be messy. There'll be a lot more like poverty and sort of, I don't know, shanty building practices, etc. I don't have a question more than just, we should probably wrap up because we've been going for a while, but
I've been talking your ear off, but yeah, you know, if you really, this kind of was my one final point, is that yeah, if you look at countries where the average person, okay, uses less energy in a year than a refrigerator, okay, so of which there are many, and so that would be like beyond the pale of what you could possibly imagine in America, right? I mean, I don't know if we're talking about like the average person having to use like half the electricity, half the energy. I mean, this would be 100 or 200 time reduction. Okay. And these countries exist now, so it's not speculative. I mean, for the average American's energy budget to fall to that of Bangladesh, I don't even think that this is part of our conversation, but just hypothetically, I mean, you know, I hate to say it, it sounds dumb, but, you know, go on YouTube, you know, it's a stupid show. Not stupid, I like it, but it's Deadliest Roads is the name of the program. And I watch it on YouTube, drop in Deadliest Roads, Bangladesh. And I mean, if you want to see what a city looks like, you know, at a per capita energy budget of less than a refrigerator, it's right there, man. It's bicycles, it's human-powered rickshaws. There's buses moving around. I mean, it's not a return to anything. You know, they're on cell phones, on, you know, Honda motorbikes. That's what it is, you know?
Yeah, totally. I don't know if, Jason, you have a final point, but I just want to briefly say that for us here in Uruguay, we're kind of like in this middle zone where we're living in a pretty comfortable way, but we had to have really good insulation in our home, have a decently sized wood stove. The climate makes it so that we don't need a ton of energy. So we have a solar water heater. We have lots of sunny days. And it's a extremely comfortable way to live for us, even, you know, growing up in Chicago in the first world. But there's a lot of infrastructure that went into it. And there's a lot of learning that goes into, for example, showering in the afternoon as opposed to the morning, because that's the sun's been shining all day, you know, learning how to use the wood stove, things of that nature. So I do think that your point is so well taken, that the transition is just, it's the level of development is a huge thing for people to keep in mind. Like, what does daily life look like with a very small energy budget, if that's what our goal is, or that's what we think is coming? Just to think about the nuances of what that actually looks like is really important. Do you have a concluding thought, Jason?
Yeah. I want to thank you for coming on. I mean, you always cause me to think, and I think you do that for all of the kind of people in the loosely defined DO network, and kind of test our assumptions, which I really appreciate. You know, if we had more time, I would want to integrate more, you know, if this idea of food production, if everyone's moving to the cities, if, you know, infrastructure maintenance, you know, falls drastically in rural areas, I'm wondering how people are going to eat and how we're going to produce food without just completely destroying the land. You know, you said that we can, as long as we have diesel, we can do a lot. But I mean, this is an issue that I'd want to interrogate more if we had more time, of, you know, where does our food come from in a low energy future? But I guess
more like a low liquid fuels future, specifically.
Hey, yeah. Jason, I've already talked too long, but man, I'll leave you with with one thing on that, of where the fuel comes from. It's not an answer. Mm-hmm. It's a question. The bottleneck on that, and you can kind of unwrap this in your own mind. I'll just be very quick. The bottleneck on that to the low carbon, you know, high labor food production, mm-hmm. is getting enough people out on the land to do it.
Yeah.
Because it takes a lot. At the same time, their consumption of those people needs to be low enough that they were making a net production, not a net cost.
Yeah.
And right now we're the opposite of that, because we have an aging society with very little young labor, and each person's consumption is so high that if you place them out on a rural parcel, and I absolutely included in this, they're not going to make a net increase of what they're consuming. They're going to be, I mean, they might defray it or have fun or do good things for their community, but so we're like the opposite. We have a small number of people, and each person consumes a tremendous amount a year, whereas the complete inverse is a large young population where each person consumes so little that they're making a net return from a small piece of land. I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, you know what? And that's so perfect to end with, because that's like exactly what Chris Mage's Small Farm Future envisions. It's like much more people doing labor, being much more productive. And again, but I think the details of this conversation really matter, because what that looks like, the social infrastructure and all of that.
I think romanticize that, and it's going to be, I think there's going to be a lot of harsh realities to that kind of romantic vision. To wrap up, is there anything else that that you want to say, something you wish we had asked you, any final imparting thoughts?
No, I think we pretty much covered a lot of ground, so it was real good talking to you.
Yeah, you too. I'm so glad we got to talk long form. So anyways, we'll let you know when this comes out, and otherwise we'll see you on Twitter.
Okay, take it easy.
All right, have a good one, Adam. Bye. Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye.